From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. April 10th, 2018 marked Equal Pay Day, a day that is meant to highlight the ongoing gender pay gap. Women, on average, earn just under 80 cents for every dollar a man earns. And broken up by race, the stats are even worse for women of color. Why? In this day and age, are women still struggling to earn equal pay? In a new book, Ricky Gard Diamond explores the history, economics, and sexist ideology that keeps women's pay low. Ricky Gard Diamond is the founding editor of Vermont Woman. She has taught writing and literature, feminist and media studies at Vermont College of Norwich University. And her new book is called Screwnomics: How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. Welcome to the program, Ricky.
I'm so glad to be with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. One of the things that I really enjoyed about your book was the way in which you have called men out and the way in which men like to explain economics as this very complicated thing that, we should try to understand if we want to make sense of why women get paid less than men. Why is that critical? To point out that economics is sometimes purposely obscured by men.
Well, yes, I call that after Rebecca Solnit's wonderful essay, Men Explain Things to Me. I call it economan-splaining, because economics has really been a man-to-man conversation for about 2,500 years, since Herodotus first named it oikonomia, you know. And not only has it been a man-to-man conversation, but a particular man of a particular race, of a particular elite education, of a particular class. And it's a relatively small group of experts who are very, very sure of themselves, but who have left out enormous things that women consider to be important, and he just expects us to listen to him without asking questions, because he mansplains it to us.
So some of these men, can you throw out some names? I know you refer to the work of Milton Friedman and others.
Well, yes. You know, I like to explain economics in a more personal way, because I think that's one of the problems there is with this man-to-man explanation, which is tries to appear to be entirely rational and not at all about feelings or anything personal, when in fact, economics is one of the most personal things there is that affects you in your daily life. So my mother gave me dating advice back in the 60s, and she told me that there were basically two kinds of men to watch out for. One was there were the gentlemen who would respect you and that you should look for. And then there were the men that she called cads. Now, today we would call them players, but when you look at our contemporary economic history, and there's a longer story than that, but when you look at the contemporary story, we've seen both these kinds of men in recent economic thinking. And the gentleman is the Lord Alfred Keynes and his approach to economics that really introduced the idea of the government being another player in making sure that the rules were fair, and that in downturns, demand was kept up through government intervention, creating jobs and making it possible for more people to participate in the economy. He thought that was a good idea, and so did a whole school of Keynesian thinkers. But then they were overthrown, as happens in the academic world, where argumentation happens and one man or another is attempting to win the argument for the moment. Overthrown by another economist, Milton Friedman was one of the leaders who introduced this other idea, this countering idea, that if you rewarded the landlords if you made it easier for the wealthiest to make more money, then that money would just naturally trickle down to us. And we've been waiting for about 40 years now for that trickle down.
And that thinking has very much dominated the ideology of politicians, elected officials in this country, mostly the Republican Party, but very much so members of the Democratic Party as well. What are the things that this, that these econo-mansplaining men leave out of our economic systems that we absolutely need to encompass? You write about the informal economy, that sort of unpaid work that's simply taken for granted that women will do, and also things like ecology and the price that our environment pays.
Right, right. I don't think it's an accident that we refer to our planet as Gaia or think of her as Mother Earth. And the economic assumption that I've named Scroonomics is this unwritten but widely applied idea that women should always work for less or better for free. And that includes our Mother Earth, and that includes men who do girly kinds of jobs like teaching or nursing, or who take care of their own kids or cook dinner. All of those are discounted in our current economic system. And a lot of the issues that I address in Scroonomics have to do with the language of economists. Your use of the term informal economy is one good example. It sort of invites the notion that, well, we don't have to take this terribly serious. It's just sort of, you know, it just happens. And it's not serious, when in fact it is foundational. It is the most essential part of any economy, no matter what form that economy takes.
And what does that include? We were talking about the job of raising children, the job of cleaning house, taking care of elders, et cetera, right?
Right. And also the work that goes on in our oceans and in our compost piles. All of that is just assumed to be free and for the taking, and without the essential care that really makes all of makes a compost pile or a good fishing hole really productive. And so ignoring that is just to ignore our biological underpinnings, both nature's and our own human economy that underlies everything else.
Ricky, your book Scroonomics is illustrated by an artist who you've collaborated with, Pico Todd, whose cartoons kind of describe the conversations that can or should happen around our country every day. Can you tell us around economics? Can you tell us a little bit about what these cartoons, which our TV audience can see, what they were intended to do?
Well, I said that I wanted to make the economy more personal, which is why I tell lots of stories about my mother and my grandmother and other women who've taken part in the economy. But I also thought it was important that we laugh at some of the absurd assumptions that economic talk has often made. And so it's unusual. We sort of expect, because of this econo-mansplaining that happens all the time, we kind of expect money to talk in a male voice. And when you talk about the economy, you sort of expect it to be men talking about it. So the cartoons are, again, different because they're the characters are women and their families, and how the economy, the macro economy that's above us all, interacts with the microeconomy where we all live, and affects actual lives. And sometimes is funny. And of course, what's funny is often, it's always funny when someone else slips on a banana peel. It's tragedy when you do it. And so there's a little bit of dark humor in there too.
Now, in addition to the ways in which the sort of trickle-down economic theory has been pushed on us, even though it doesn't work, there's also this whole ideology of growth and economic growth that we have taken for granted, but really is a masculine, misogynist, sexist ideology too, right? This endless growth that any economic explanation of anything that is supposed to work well is equated with growth. If there's growth, it's good. If there's no growth or if there's sluggish growth, it's bad. How is it important? How important is it for us to call that out?
Well, I think it's really essential that we talk about amongst ourselves about what this growth really means, that when it doesn't trickle down, where does it go? It piles up in big mountains of money that certain men of, you know, a particular race, of a particular culture and expectation for profit and winning, then, you know, measure against one another.
Are you saying it's not just a pure coincidence that all our top billionaires are white men?
I suspect it is not.
Right. So the calling out of these economic truisms that we've been told to accept, how do you relate that to the facts on the ground that women are constantly paid less than men? Let's link the calling out of this ideology to the real facts of women earning less money than men. And as I mentioned, for women of color, it's even worse. Do you see this gender pay gap as a direct outcome of a male-dominated, male-centered economic system?
Well, I do think it is essential to how we organize the haves and the have-nots. It's a very complicated answer. I mean, it's why I had to write a book about it, because there are a lot of layers to this. But, you know, when you look at our long human history, dating back 40,000 years, when land was not rare, real estate wasn't rare, people were. And so if coming out of the Ice Age, Mastodon stepped on some of your most important family members and you were afraid of not making it through the winter without enough people, you'd have to raid the next tribe to carry off a woman who was less able to resist than a man. You might have to kill him, and that's how war started. But you'd carry off the woman, and her sexual reproductive powers were really essential to the health of the tribe. And so the mother of women's history, which not so long ago, remember, was kind of an oxymoron. History wasn't about women. It was about kings and
his story. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So she says that women's sexual reproductive powers were the first property. And when you look closely at agriculture, which began about 10,000 years ago, you see, and was the basis of every important ancient civilization, ownership of women as concubines or as slaves were foundation stones of those civilizations. And that kind of expectation stayed with us. And there's really, you know, there are some reminders in our culture, like the wedding ceremonies, where most often the father of the bride gives her away to the groom. You know, there are these little reminders, which now are just
the handing over of property from one man to the other, basically.
Yes, exactly. And there's a reason why she takes his name and not the other way around. So these are echoes of what used to be. So now, in the industrial age, which wasn't so long ago, maybe what, 300 years ago now, transformed how we thought about work. It separated work, which used to be done at home, often by women who were manufacturers of raw materials, to another place, to a factory where it could be done more efficiently, like weaving cloth, which had always been women's responsibility, was removed from the home and taken to the marketplace. And as a result, she was transformed from a producer, from a producer of wealth in the homestead, to what is now called a consumer, which is not a terribly flattering word either. And now, instead of producing wealth for her family in the form of labor for wealth production at home, she became this consumer and now had to pay for the cost of children. So now the USDA estimates that to raise a child in the U.S. That's born this year, it will cost about $700,000 to raise that child, feed that child, and that's not even counting college costs. So that source of wealth has become an expense to families. And of course, it's very uncomfortable to think about the cost of children. You know, you don't even, that's just, we're supposed to be in this separate realm where we continue to be the angel of the house who takes care of things and never thinks about money.
So the second part of your book subtitle is Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. Let's focus on that as we close out our conversation. What are some real ways? You know, one of the problems with the sort of acceptance of econo-mansplaining, as you put it, is that we tend to think that we don't have any power to change things, but we do. So what are some ways in which women can lead the way to changing this economic system that we are told to accept?
Well, I put this book together to create a kind of female body of knowledge around economics. And there are already so many women who are, as you say, leading the way to new ways of thinking. Examples are Marjorie Kelly, who has begun to talk about the importance of cooperative ownership. And there are women's organizations around the country and around the world that are doing more of this cooperative ownership, where once they would be employees, they're investing and they're not only creating jobs, but in some cases, I'm thinking now of a wonderful Latina group there out on the West Coast called Prospera, which has enabled women to become self-employed and earn good livings with home maintenance, but also creating their own cleaning products. And now they're expanding into the restaurant business because they want traditional cooking to be part of their community and you know, share that tradition of making wealth with food, creating new methods for that. Other ways that I think women are expanding the conversation is with labor unions, which, you know, have traditionally been at war with the corporate owners and the unions. That it was always framed as a kind of fight between these two entities about wages. And way back in 1900, a woman named Rose Schneiderman said, you know, we need bread, but we also need roses. And so women at that time were talking about, well, let's talk about what work really is. And beyond work, what is our life about? You know, why are we working? What is the purpose of our work? And I see women in labor unions continuing to do that same kind of expansion of the conversation to include a wider community, to talk about, for instance, the restaurant opportunity centers that are doing such great work, are not only talking about sick pay for workers that you don't want sneezing in your food, but also the nature of the food system and what diners really want to have too, and why we're all better off when we eat fresh food locally. So those kinds of expansions of the usual beyond money, not just talking about money, but talking about the wider purposes of money and our human connections, I think, distinguish the way so many women tend to be more inclusive. Another example is Ellen Brown, who is talking about the importance of public banking, which we have one public bank in the nation, and that's in North Dakota, a red state that you wouldn't think of as being so liberal and lefty, and they're not. But they are independent, and they set their own. Instead of depositing their tax money on Wall Street for global speculation, they are keeping their money at home and using it to fund things that they've decided are important, like small businesses and farming and student loans. They have really low student loan rates, and then putting that interest profit that they make at a lower rate, returning that to taxpayers. You know, well, what do you know? I mean, maybe that's not such a bad idea. And I think it would be a really valuable counterbalance to what's going on in Wall Street and Washington right now. So those are a few examples. There's alternative currencies that are out there. I throw out my own idea about one of those. And then I do have to talk about, you know, I was talking about the way that women in unions are thinking more widely. In India, the self-employed women of India approached the government and said, "We want to form a union." And the government said, "Well, no, you can't do that. You're employers. You can't be in a union." And they said, "Well, yes, we can." And so they kept up resisting, and they did form a union, and they set union standards for self-employed women in India. But then they went beyond that. They imagined themselves as this big, not as these architectural boxes, you know, or a pyramid with the president at the very top or something. They pictured a banyan tree with living leaves that were the members, and with trunks that went down to the ground and created all kinds of connections. So they worked at providing services that self-employed women needed, like childcare and business education at an academy that they created. And then they also decided that they needed to create their own bank. And so they began to form financial offices that provided mentoring services. And so when you forget about waging the economy as a war, and instead you decide to wage life, you can do so much more than compete. You can cooperate, collaborate, and partner with people, and see that everyone is able to eat and has clean socks at the end of the day, you know?
Well, Ricky, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out more about your book.
Yes, go to www.screwnomics.org. We have a Facebook page where we feature Sunday tunes. And we have a Twitter feed, and we're out there. We're now available in just about every bookstore there is, and on Amazon, too, if you must. But you can find us. We're out there.
We'll put links to your sites from our site. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Ricky Gard Diamond is my guest. She's a founding editor of Vermont Woman. She's taught writing and literature, feminist, and media studies at Vermont College of Norwich University. We've been discussing her new book, Screwnomics, How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.